This afternoon we want to talk about C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce. I had indicated, I think, earlier in the week that it's probably my favorite. I have often used it in classes, and usually here at Holden I've used a whole week to discuss it because it's just jam-packed with things. Are there any other copies of The Great Divorce here? Does anybody else have one? You've got one. All right. Good. Couple of them. How many of you? I want to do at least one thing this afternoon. I want to read one of the sessions, one of the episodes in dialogue, and I think we can work that out. Why don't you bring your copy? It's Between Two Men. So sit up in this chair here, and then we'll work it in later on. It's the fifth chapter, I think, which is or the fourth chapter. It's the big ghost. Because it illustrates so nicely so many of the things that Lewis does. How many of you have read The Great Divorce? Even if you don't have a copy here, how many of you have read? Hardly any. Oh, it's one of the least read, but it's also one of his best books. Lewis wrote this in 1945, or at least it was first published, I think, in 1945. It says copyright 46. Well, he wrote it in 45 and published it in 46. It's a novel, but it is an unusual kind of novel. It's first of all, it is episodic. That is, the only continuing character is the narrator himself, probably Lewis. And so what we are doing is experiencing the story in terms of the narrator. He is the continuing character, and the episodes are rarely episodes in which he plays a role. They're mostly episodes in which he is observing other people. It's sort of like this. It's like Alistair Cook doing Masterpiece Theater, in which Cook sort of observes what's going on and fills you in a little bit, and then there are episodes. Occasionally several characters show up again, like the big man in chapter 4 ends up in a couple of episodes. Now, what Lewis, so the first thing is its character as episodic fiction. The second thing that happens in The Great Divorce is that it's about heaven and hell. And sort of, I think. But as we know from this kind of fiction, where you are really setting the story in the life beyond death, it's really not about the life beyond death, but it's like this life. If you read Dante's Divine Comedy, Heaven, Hell, and Purgatory, you notice that he populates it continually with his own contemporaries. He's especially delightful in the way he populates hell with his current political enemies, bishops and the rulers of various types and popes and so on. So in one sense, one could say the Divine Comedy is not in the first instance really Dante's vision of what it is going to be like after we die, but Dante's vision of what in fact was going on in the politics of Italy in his own time. So Lewis's novel, too, is not really, in the last analysis, a description of heaven and hell at all. What it is a description about is the kind of choices that we make here and now, and above all, the kind of bondage that we are able to create for ourselves by the choices that we make. We are in the process of becoming something, Lewis would say. We are in the process of becoming either saints or demons, angels or devils. That is what is going on here. Lewis is absolutely convinced that we are destined to live forever, and that we are shaping our eternal destiny right here. So what he is doing is arranging for a group of people to take a day trip to the vestibule of heaven. And in the process of that kind of a fictive device, he wants to illuminate the kinds of choices and situations into which we get ourselves. In the process, he takes up a number of key topics and does this in a very imaginative way. Maybe a third introductory comment, and then I'm going to do some reading and commenting as we go along. Lewis's main point is that hell is nothing so much as illusion. It is a state of mind, he says at one point in the novel. By that he does not mean that it lacks reality, because illusions and states of mind can also have reality. They can be compelling reality, life-shaping reality. If I'm paranoid, I am first of all playing on a real thing. I mean, there are some things we ought to be afraid of. I ought to be afraid of being caught on a railroad track when a train is hurtling through at 80 miles an hour. I ought to be afraid of that. There are some things that we really ought to fear. My colleague Lee Elhard, who is here this summer, has a poster in his office that reads, "Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you." So the point is, there may really be enemies. There are real things that are hostile to me, things that I ought to be afraid of. Now, paranoia plays on that kind of legitimate emotion. Only now it operates with illusion. If I am sitting here looking around the room and saying, "I wonder why all of these people are looking at me. I bet they're plotting against me. Oh, and I even see that woman nodding over there. That's a sure sign that a plot is afoot." You see, I may in fact take measures to protect myself. I may pick up this stick and want to ward you off, you see, so that it's all an illusion. You aren't really plotting against me. Are you? I didn't think so. So it is all an illusion in my own mind. Nevertheless, it is the kind of illusion that can actually determine my behavior, my attitudes, how I react toward all of you, how I will think about you. It will be a life-shaping illusion. So to call hell a state of mind does not imply that it lacks power, but only that the kind of power that it has is perversion, and it's a destructive power. Heaven, Lewis says, is reality itself. But now, curiously, for people who have lived with illusion, the encounter with reality is bound to be painful. And the way in which Lewis describes these contrasts and the reason for it is, I think, extremely illuminating. And that's the best way to get into that, I think, is just to read along. I'll start with the first chapter, and we'll see how far we can get. I want to, above all, at least have us do the fourth chapter as a kind of dialogue session later on. I seemed to be standing in a bus queue by the side of a long mean street. Evening was just closing in, and it was raining. I had been wandering for hours in similar mean streets, always in the rain, always in evening twilight. Time seemed to have paused on that dismal moment when only a few shops have lit up and it is not yet dark enough for their windows to look cheering. And just as the evening never advanced tonight, so my walking had never brought me to the better parts of the town. However far I went, I found only dingy lodging houses, small tobacconists, hoardings from which posters hung in rags, windowless warehouses, goods stations without trains, and bookshops of the sort that sell the works of Aristotle. Never met anyone, but for the little crowd at the bus stop, the whole town seemed to be empty. I think that was why I attached myself to the queue. I had a stroke of luck right away, for just as I took my stand, a little waspish woman who would have been ahead of me snapped out at a man who seemed to be with her, "Very well, then I won't go at all, so there," and left the queue. "Pray don't imagine," said the man in a very dignified voice, "that I care about going in the least. I've only been trying to please you, for peace sake. My own feelings are, of course, a matter of no importance. I quite understand that." And suiting the action to the word, he also walked away. Yesterday, when we were reading Screwtape Letters, Lewis talked about how the words could be quite harmless, but the way you said them could be just twisting the knife. That's exactly what this man is doing here. Come, I thought to myself, that's two places gained. I was now next to a very short man with a scowl, who glanced at me with an expression of extreme disfavor and observed, rather unnecessarily loudly, to the man beyond him, "This sort of thing really makes one think twice about going at all." "What sort of thing?" growled the other, a big, beefy person. "Well," said the short man, "this is hardly the sort of society I'm used to, as a matter of fact." "Huh!" said the big man, and then added with a glance at me, "Don't you stand any sauce from him, mister. You're not afraid of him, are you?" And seeing I made no move, he rounded suddenly on the short man and said, "Not good enough for you, aren't we? I like your lip." Next moment he had fetched the short man one on the side of the face that sent him sprawling into the gutter. "Let him lay, let him lay," said the big man to no one in particular. "I'm a plain man, that's what I am. I gotta have my rights, same as anyone else, see?" And as the short man showed no disposition to rejoin the queue, and soon began limping away, I closed up rather cautiously behind the big man and congratulated myself on having gained yet another step. A moment later, two young people in front of him also left us, arm in arm. They were both so trousered, slender, giggly, and falsetto that I could be sure of the sex of neither, but it was clear that each for the moment preferred the other to a chance of a place on the bus. "We shall never all get in," said a female voice with a whine in it from some four places ahead of me. "Change places with you for $5, lady," said someone else. I heard the clink of money and then a scream in the female voice mixed with roars of laughter from the rest of the crowd. The cheated woman leaped out of her place to fly at the man who had bilked her, but the others immediately closed up and flung her out. So what with one thing and another, the queue had reduced itself to manageable proportions long before the bus arrived. It was a wonderful vehicle, blazing with golden light, heraldically colored. The driver himself seemed full of light, and he used only one hand to drive with. The other he waved before his face as if to fan away the greasy steam of the rain. A growl went up from the queue as he came in sight. "Looks as if he had a good enough time of it. Bloody pleased with himself, I'll bet. My dear, why can't he behave naturally? Thinks himself too good to look at us. Who does he imagine he is? All that gilding in purple, I call it a wicked waste. Why don't they spend some of their money on their house property down here? God, I'd like to give him one in the ear hole." I could see nothing in the countenance of the driver to justify all this, unless it were that he had a look of authority and seemed intent on carrying out his job. My fellow passengers fought like hens to get on board the bus, though there was plenty of room for us all. I was the last to get in. The bus was only half full, and I selected a seat at the back, well away from the others. But a tousle-headed youth at once came and sat down beside me, and as he did, we moved off. "Thought you wouldn't mind my tacking on to you," he said, "for I've noticed that you feel just as I do about the present company. Why on earth they insist on coming, I can't imagine. They won't like it at all when we get there. They'd really be much more comfortable at home. It's different for you and me." "Do they like this place?" I asked. "Oh, as much as they'd like anything," he answered. "They've got cinemas and fish and ship shops and advertisements and all the sorts of things they'd want. The appalling lack of intellectual life doesn't worry them. I realized as soon as I got here that there'd been some mistake. I ought to have taken the first bus, but I've fooled around trying to wake people up here. I found a few fellows I'd known before and tried to form a little circle, but they all seemed to have sunk to the level of their surroundings. Why, even before we came here, I'd had some doubts about a man like Cyril Blellow. I always thought he was working in a false idiom, but at least he was intelligent. One could get some criticism worth hearing from him, even if he was a failure on the creative side. But now he seems to have nothing left but his self-conceit. Why, the last time I tried to read him some of my own stuff... But wait a minute, I'd like you to look at it." Realizing with a shudder that what he was producing from his pocket was a thick wad of typewritten paper, I muttered something about not having my spectacles and exclaimed, "Hello, we've left the ground." It was true. Several hundred feet below us, already half hidden in the rain and mist, the wet roofs of the town appeared, spreading without a break as far as eye could reach. Well, I'm going to skip the next part about the tousle-headed youth and so on. To page 18. It was just then that we were interrupted. One of the quarrels perpetually simmering in the bus had boiled over, and for a moment there was a stampede. Knives were drawn, pistols fired, but it all seemed strangely innocuous. And when it was over, I found myself unharmed, though in a different seat and with a new companion. He was an intelligent-looking man, with a rather bulbous nose and a bowler hat. I looked out of the window, We were now so high that all below us had become featureless, but fields, rivers, or mountains I did not see, and I got the impression that the gray town still filled the whole field of vision. Seems a deuce of a town, I volunteered. And that's what I can't understand. The parts of it that I saw were so empty. Wasn't there once a larger population? Not at all, said my neighbor. The trouble is they're so quarrelsome. As soon as anyone arrives, he settles in some street. Before he's been there 24 hours, he quarrels with his neighbor. Before the week is over, he's quarreled so badly he decides to move. Very like he'll find the next street empty because all the people there have quarreled with their neighbors and moved on. So he settles in. If by any chance the street is full, he goes further. But even if he stays, it makes no odds. He's sure to have another quarrel pretty soon, and he'll move on again. Finally, he'll move right out to the edge of town and build a new house. You see, it's easy here. You've only got to think a house, and there it is. That's how the town keeps on growing. I think what Lewis is doing here is saying, in one sense at least, that each of us lives in an environment which we create. We think the houses, that is, we imagine them. I fill the space around me with my imaginings of what you are and what you do and what you expect and therefore what I am and what I do and what I can expect. So I create my house, my environment. Leaving more and more empty streets, I said. That's right. And time's sort of odd here. That place where we caught the bus is thousands of miles from the civic center where all the newcomers arrive from Earth. All the people you've met were living near the bus stop, but they've taken centuries of our time to get there by gradual removals. And what about earlier arrivals? I mean, there must be people who came from Earth to your town even longer ago. That's right, there are. They've been moving on and on, getting farther apart. They're so far off by now that they could never think of coming to the bus stop at all. Astronomical distances. There's a bit of a rising ground near where I live, and a chap has a telescope. You can see the lights of the inhabitant houses where the old ones live, millions of miles away, millions of miles from us and from one another. Every now and then they move further still. That's one of the disappointments. I thought you'd meet interesting historical characters, but you don't. They're too far away. Would they get to the bus stop in time if they ever set out? Well, theoretically, but it'd be a distance of light years. And they wouldn't want to by now, not those old chaps like Tamburlaine and Genghis Khan or Julius Caesar or Henry V. Wouldn't want to. That's right. The nearest of those old ones is Napoleon. We know that because two chaps made the journey to see him. They'd started long before I came, of course, but I was there when they came back. 15,000 years of our time it took them. We've picked out the house by now, just a little pinprick of light and nothing else near it for millions of miles. But they got there? That's right. He built himself a huge house all in the Empire style, rows of windows flaming with light, though it only shows as a pinprick from where I live. Did they see Napoleon? Oh, they did. They went right up and looked through one of the windows. Napoleon was there, all right. What was he doing? Walking up and down all the time, left, right, never stopping for a moment. The two chaps watched him about a year and he never rested, muttering to himself all the time, it was Sue's fault, it was Ney's fault, it was Josephine's fault, it was the fault of the Russians, it was the fault of the English. Like that all the time, never stopped for a moment, a little fat man and he looked kind of tired. But he didn't seem able to stop it. Bunch of things. Let me comment on this. If the houses that we build are illusory, as Lewis wants to suggest they are, as if they are really ways of protecting ourselves from others, then we will, in fact, be moving farther and farther away from each other. He's trying to signal alienation, really. That's what's going on here. Only he's doing it by means of imaginary houses and a town that just spreads out almost infinitely. One other thing. Napoleon is locked in his prison. He doesn't seem able to stop it, Lewis says, you know, and his prison is blaming others for his defeats, marching up and down, always trapped in that world where he's trying to find the reason for his defeats and laying it on somebody else. building your own prison, in a sense. From the vibrations, I gathered that the bus was still moving, but there was now nothing to be seen from the windows which confirmed this, nothing but the gray void above and below. "Then the town will go on spreading indefinitely," I said. "That's right," said the intelligent man, "unless someone can do something about it." "How do you mean?" "Well, as a matter of fact, between you and me and the wall, that's my job at the moment. What's the trouble with this place? Not that people are quarrelsome. That's only human nature and was always the same even on Earth. The trouble is they have no needs. You get everything you want. Not very good quality, of course, but everything you want just by imagining it. That's why it never costs any trouble to move to another street or build another house. In other words, there's no proper economic basis for any community life. Now, if they needed real shops, chaps would have to stay near where the real shops were. If they needed real houses, they'd have to stay where the builders were. It's scarcity that enables a society to exist. Well, that's where I come in. I'm not going this trip for my health. Far as that goes, don't think it would suit me up there. But if I can come back with some real commodities, anything at all that you could really bite or drink or sit on, why, at once you'd get a demand down in our town. I'd start a little business. I'd have something to sell. You'd soon get people coming to live near. Centralization. Two fully inhabited streets would accommodate the people that are now spread over a million square miles of empty streets. Make a nice little profit and be a public benefactor as well." "You mean if they had to live together, they'd gradually learn to quarrel less?" "Well, I don't know about that. I dare say they could be kept a bit quieter. You'd have a chance to build up a police force, knock some kind of discipline into them. Anyway," and here he dropped his voice, "it'd be better, you know. Everyone admits that. Safety in numbers." "Safety from what?" I began. But my companion nudged me to be silent. I changed my question. "But look here," I said. "If they can get everything just by imagining it, why would they want any real things, as you call them? Eh? Oh, well, they'd like houses that really kept out the rain." "Their present houses don't?" "Well, of course not. How could they? What the devil is the use of building them, then?" The intelligent man put his head very close to mine. "Safety," he muttered. "At least the feeling of safety. It's all right now. But later on, you'd understand?" "What?" I said, involuntarily sinking my own voice to a whisper. He articulated noiselessly, as if expecting that I understood lip reading. I put my ear close to his mouth. "Speak up," I said. "It will be dark presently," he mouthed. "You mean the evening is really going to turn into night in the end?" He nodded. "What's that got to do with it?" said I. "Well, no one wants to be out of doors when that happens." "Why?" His reply was so furtive I had to ask him to repeat it several times, and when he had done so, being a little annoyed, as one so often is with whisperers, I replied without remembering to lower my voice. "Who are they?" I asked. "And what are you afraid they'll do to you? And why should they come out when it's dark? And what protection could an imaginary house give if there was any danger?" "Here," shouted the big man, "who's talking all that stuff? You stop your whispering, you two, if you don't want a hiding, see? Spreading rumors, that's what I call it. You shut your face, Ikey, see? Quite right, scandalous, ought to be prosecuted. How did they get in the bus?" growled the other passengers. A fat, clean-shaven man who sat on the seat in front of me leaned back and addressed me in a cultured voice. Turns out later he's the bishop. Ikey turns up later in another episode, too, the entrepreneur. "Excuse me," he said, "but I couldn't help overhearing part of your conversation. It is astonishing how these primitive superstitions linger on. I beg your pardon. Oh, God bless my soul, that's all it is. There isn't a shred of evidence that this twilight is ever going to turn into a night. There has been a revolution of opinion on that in educated circles. I'm surprised you haven't heard of it. All the nightmare fantasies of our ancestors are being swept away. What we now see in this subdued and delicate half-light is the promise of the dawn, the slow turning of a whole nation towards the light. Slow and imperceptible, of course, and not through eastern windows only, when daylight comes, comes in the light. And that passion for real commodities which our friend speaks of is only materialism, you know. It's retrogressive, earthbound, a hankering for matter. But we look on this spiritual city, for with all its faults it is spiritual, as a nursery in which the creative functions of man, now freed from the clogs of matter, begin to try their wings. A sublime thought. Hours later, there came a change. It began to grow light in the bus. The grayness outside the windows turned from mud color to mother of pearl, then to faintest blue, then to bright blueness that stung the eyes. We seemed to be floating in a pure vacancy. There were no lands, no sun, no stars in sight, only the radiant abyss. I let down the window beside me. Delicious freshness came in for a second, and then, "What the hell are you doing?" shouted the intelligent man, leaning roughly across me and pulling the window sharply up. "Want us all to catch our death of cold?" "Hit him a biff," said the big man. I glanced round the bus. Though the windows were closed and soon muffed, the bus was full of light. It was cruel light. I shrank from the faces and forms by which I was surrounded. They were all fixed faces, full not of possibilities, but of impossibilities. Some gaunt, some bloated, some glaring, with idiotic ferocity, some drowned beyond recovery, in dreams, but all in one way or another distorted and faded. One had the feeling that they might fall to pieces at any moment if the light grew much stronger. And then there was a mirror on the end wall of the bus. I caught sight of my own face, and still the light grew. A cliff loomed up ahead. It sank vertically beneath us so far that I could not see the bottom, and it was dark and smooth. We were mounting all the time. At last the top of the cliff became visible, like a thin line of emerald green stretched tight as a fiddle string. Presently we glided over the top. We were flying above a level, grassy country through which there ran a wide river. We were losing height now. Some of the tallest treetops were only 20 feet below us. Then suddenly we were at rest. Everyone had jumped up. Curses, taunts, blows, a filth of vituperation came to my ears as my fellow passengers struggled to get out. A moment later, and they had all succeeded. I was alone in the bus, and through the open door there came to me in the fresh stillness the singing of a lark. I got out. The light and coolness that drenched me were like those of summer morning, early morning, a minute or two before sunrise, only there was a certain difference. I had a sense of being in a larger space, perhaps even a larger sort of space than I had ever known before, as if the sky were further off and the extent of the green plain wider than they could be on this little ball of earth. I got out in some sense, which made the solar system itself seem like an indoor affair. It gave me a feeling of freedom, but also of exposure, possibly danger, which continued to accompany me through all that followed. It is the impossibility of communicating that feeling, or even inducing you to remember it as I proceed, which makes me despair of conveying the real quality of what I saw and heard. At first, of course, my attention was caught by my fellow passengers, who were still grouped about in the neighborhood of the omnibus, though beginning, some of them, to walk forward into the landscape with hesitating steps. I gasped when I saw them. Now that they were in the light, they were transparent, fully transparent, when they stood between me and it, smudgy and imperfectly opaque. When they stood in the shadow of some tree, they were in fact ghosts, man-shaped stains on the brightness of that air. One could attend to them or ignore them, at will, as you do with dirt on a window pane. I noticed that the grass did not bend under their feet. Even the dewdrops were not disturbed. Then some readjustment of the mind or some focusing of my eyes took place, and I saw the whole phenomenon the other way around. The men were as they always had been, as all the men I had known had been, perhaps. It was the light, the grass, the trees that were different, made of some different substance, so much solider than things in our country, that men were ghosts by comparison. What Lewis is doing here is saying, in one sense, that if we really are in contact with heaven, with God, that we can be seen through. all of the defenses that we build for ourselves are just that. They are illusions, and they can be seen through. Just as you see through someone's excuse when he or she makes an excuse. You know, we say it, in fact. You can see right through that. Moved by a sudden thought, I bent down and tried to pluck a daisy, which was growing at my feet. The stalk wouldn't break. I tried to twist it, but it wouldn't twist. I tugged till the sweat stood out on my forehead, and I had lost most of the skin off my hands. The little flower was hard, not like wood or even like iron, but like diamond. There was a leaf, a young, tender beech leaf, lying in the grass beside it. I tried to pick the leaf up. My heart almost cracked with the effort, and I believe I did just raise it. But I had to let it go at once. It was heavier than a sack of coal. As I stood recovering my breath with great gasps and looking down at the daisy, I noticed that I could see the grass not only between my feet, but through them. I, too, was a phantom. Who will give me words to express the terror of that discovery? Golly, thought I, I'm in for it this time. I don't like it, I don't like it, screamed a voice. It gives me the pip. One of the ghosts had darted past me back into the bus. She never came out of it again, as far as I know. The others remained uncertain. Hey, mister, said the big man, addressing the driver, when do we have to go back? You need never go back unless you want to, he replied. Stay as long as you please. There was an awkward pause. This is simply ridiculous, said a voice in my ear. One of the quieter and more respectable ghosts had sidled up to me. There must be some mismanagement, he continued. What's the sense of allowing all that riffraff to float about here all day? Look at them. They're not enjoying it. They'd be far happier at home. They don't even know what to do. Well, I don't know very well myself, I said. What does one do? Oh, me, I shall be met in a moment or two. I'm expected. I'm not bothering about that. But it is rather unpleasant on one's first day to have the whole place crowded out with trippers. Damn it, one's chief object in coming here at all is to avoid them. He drifted away from me, and I began to look about. In spite of his reference to a crowd, the solitude was so vast I could hardly notice the knot of phantoms in the foreground. Greenness and light had almost swallowed them up. But very far away I could see what might be either a great bank of cloud or a range of mountains. Sometimes I could make out in it steep forests, far withdrawing valleys, and even mountain cities perched on inaccessible summits. At other times it became indistinct. The height was so enormous that my waking sight could not have taken in such an object at all. Light brooded on the top of it. Slanting down, thence it made long shadows behind every tree on the plain. There was no change, no progression as the hours passed. The promise or the threat of sunrise rested immovably there. Long after that, I saw people coming to meet us. Because they were bright, I saw them while they were still very distant. And at first, I did not know that they were people at all. Mile after mile they drew nearer. The earth shook under their tread as their strong feet sank into the wet turf. A tiny haze and a sweet smell went up where they had crushed the grass and scattered the dew. Some were naked and some robed, but the naked ones did not seem less adorned, and the robes did not disguise in those who wore them the massive grandeur of muscle and the radiant smoothness of flesh. Some were bearded, but no one in that company struck me as being of any particular age. One gets glimpses, even in our country, of that which is ageless, heavy thought in the face of an infant, and frolic childhood in that of an old man. Here it was all like that. They came on steadily. I did not entirely like it. Two of the ghosts screamed and ran for the bus. The rest of us huddled close together. One of these bright spirits, then, meets the big man, whom we have already met on the bus. And let's start on the top of 32. You can read the role of the big man. Starts, well, I'm damned, and just leave out the said the ghost. It reads almost like a dialogue. We'll just eliminate. And every once in a while, I think I just want to make a comment or two as we go along. One of the things you'll notice about Lewis is his wordplay here, his double entendres. This man starts out, "Well, I'm damned," which is just an expression, of course, except that he really is. All right.
"Well, I'm damned. I wouldn't have believed it. It's a fair knockout. It isn't right, Len, you know. What about poor Jack, huh? You look pretty pleased with yourself, but what I say is, what about poor Jack?"
"He is here. You will meet him soon if you stay."
"But you murdered him."
"Of course I did. It's all right now."
"All right, is it? All right for you, you mean. But what about the poor chap himself, laying cold and dead?"
"But he isn't. I've told you, you will meet him soon. He sent you his love."
"What I'd like to understand is what you're here for, as pleased as punch, you, a bloody murderer, while I've been walking the streets down there and living in a place like a pigsty all these years."
"That is a little hard to understand at first, but it's all over now. You will be pleased about it presently. Till then, there is no need to bother about it."
"No need to bother about it? Aren't you ashamed of yourself?"
"No, not as you mean. I do not look at myself. I have given up myself. I had to, you know, after the murder." The double entendre again. He gave himself up, probably to the police, but also gave himself up, in a sense, to, well, we'll see to what. "I had to, you know, after the murder. That's what it did for me, and that was how everything began."
"Personally," said, well, I better read this whole thing. "Personally," said the big ghost, with an emphasis which contradicted the ordinary meaning of the word, "personally, I'd have thought you and I ought to be the other way around. That's my personal opinion."
"Very likely we soon shall be, if you'll stop thinking about it."
"Look at me now," slapping his chest, but the slap made no noise. "I'd gone straight all my life. I don't say I was a religious man, and I don't say I had no faults. Far from it. But I'd done my best all my life, see? I'd done my best by everyone. That's the sort of chap I was. I never asked for anything that wasn't mine by rights. If I wanted a drink, I paid for it. If I took my wages, I'd done my job, see? That's the sort I was. I don't care who knows it."
"It would be much better not to go on about that now."
"Who's going on? I'm not arguing. I'm just telling you the sort of chap I was, see? I'm asking for nothing but my rights. You may think you can put me down because you're dressed up like that, which you weren't when you worked under me. And I'm only a poor man, but I got to have my rights, same as you, see?"
Comment here. All of us expect that if we only get our rights, you see, it'll be a good thing. We say, this isn't my day when things are going badly. Or this is my day when they're going very well. Because, of course, things are supposed to go well. If only we had our rights. So his last line was, "I've got to have my rights, same as you, see?" Lewis goes on, "Oh, no, it's not so bad as all that. I haven't got my rights or I shouldn't be here. You won't get yours either. You'll get something far better. Never fear."
"That's just what I say. I haven't got my rights."
He doesn't understand. See, he just doesn't.
"I always done my best, and I never done anything wrong. And what I don't see is why I should be put below a bloody murderer like you."
"Who knows whether you will be? Only be happy and come with me."
"What do you keep on arguing for? I'm only telling you the sort of chap I am. I only want my rights. I'm not asking for anybody's bleeding charity."
"Then do, at once, ask for the bleeding charity." Bloody, by the way, in the English epitaph comes from medieval times when they swore by God's blood, that is, by the blood of the Eucharist. And so bloody then came to be a kind of all-purpose expletive. And again, Lewis's play, "I'm not asking for anybody's bleeding charity," could just as well be bloody charity. And Lewis turns that into what it really is, cursing is always a play on the reality. You know, you hit your thumb with a hammer and you say, "God damn it," Well, there is such a thing as God being able to damn something, so our expletives are always a play on the reality. Yesterday, remember, in Screwtape Letters, Screwtape says at one point, remember, we can't invent any pleasures, see. Hell can only parody the realities that God has invented, even the pleasures. Lewis is playing on that again, too. Then do so at once. Ask for the bleeding charity. Everything is here for the asking. Nothing can be bought.
That may be very well for you, I dare say. If they choose to let in a bloody murderer, all because he makes a poor mouth at the last moment, that's their lookout. But I don't see myself going in the same boat with you, see. Why should I? I don't want charity. I'm a decent man, and if I had my rights, I'd be here long ago, and you can tell them I said so.
You can never do it like that. Your feet will never grow hard enough to walk on our grass that way. You'd be tired out before we got to the mountains. And it isn't exactly true, you know. Lewis adds here, mirth danced in his eyes. Now he's about to lay a heavy word on him, but he's not doing it as his accuser, he's doing it as his admonisher. And the distinction between accusation and admonition is a key one. When I become your accuser, I am really trying to get you and save myself, or I'm trying to get you at save myself at your expense. Admonition means I am available to you to help you mirror, or to be a mirror to you, to mirror the truth that you so far can't see but need to see. In accusation, I do it for my sake. In admonition, I do it for the other's sake, you see. And all of these bright spirits in each of the conversations that Lewis writes about here in the book, all of the bright spirits are there for the sake of the ghosts. That's the astonishing thing. See, they're there for the sake of the ghosts. All right.
What isn't true?
Well, you weren't a decent man, and you didn't do your best. Oh, we none of us were, and we none of us did. Lord bless you, it doesn't matter. There's no need to go into it all now.
You have the face to tell me I wasn't a decent chap?
Of course. Must I go into all that? I will tell you one thing to begin with. Murdering old Jack wasn't the worst thing I did. That was the work of a moment, and I was half mad when I did it. But I murdered you in my heart deliberately for years. I used to lie awake nights thinking what I'd do to you if I ever got the chance. You see, that's why I've been sent to you now, to ask your forgiveness, to be your servant as long as you need one, and longer if it pleases you. I was the worst, but all the men who worked under you felt the same. You made it hard for us, you know, and you made it hard for your wife, too, and for your children.
You mind your own business, young man, said the ghost. None of your lips, see. Because I'm not taking any impudence from you about my private affairs.
Oh, there are no private affairs.
And I'll tell you another thing. You can clear off, see. You're not wanted. I may be only a poor man, but I'm not making pals with a murderer, let alone taking lessons from him. Made it hard for you and your like, did I? If I had you back there, I'd show you what work is.
Oh, come and show me now. It will be joy going to the mountains, but there will be plenty of work.
You don't suppose I'd go with you?
Oh, don't refuse. Here again, one of Lewis's points. None of us gets to the mountains alone. This morning I talked about this in the Bible study, quoting Herb Brokering again. It takes two to be Jesus, he says. Well, there is no way for us to experience redemption all by ourselves. It takes someone to give us insight, courage. The word of God is meant to be spoken between people. I can say the truth about you to you, and you can say the truth to me about me. We see each other, we see ourselves better if others can help us to see ourselves more honestly. So you'll never get there alone, is Lewis's point. Now the ghost goes on.
So that's the trick, is it? Shouted the ghost, outwardly bitter, and yet I thought there was a kind of triumph in its voice. Okay, I guess it's
keep
the rest
going.
Of
yeah.
Okay.
I thought there. Your
it
line.
It had been entreated. It could make a refusal, and this seemed to be a kind of advantage. I thought there'd been some damned nonsense. It's all a clique, all a bloody clique. Tell them I'm not coming. See, I'd rather be damned than go along with you. I came here to get my rights, see, not to go sniveling along on charity tied onto your apron strings. If they're too fine to have me without you, I'll go home. It was almost happy now that it could, in a sense, threaten. That's what I'll do, it repeated. I'll go home. I didn't come here to be treated like a dog. I'll go home. That's what I'll do. Damn and blast the whole pack of you.
Yes. Now, notice another thing here. Lewis refers to the ghost as it, not he. It's a thing. It is not yet real. It isn't. It certainly isn't a human being and doesn't deserve a pronoun. Well, that's an example of the kind of dialogues Lewis has got. There are so many others. Chapter 5 is about a bishop, the cultured bishop who didn't really want to believe the superstitious things anymore. In this chapter, Lewis talks about sins of the intellect. And the bishop ends up saying, no, he couldn't really stay. He had founded a little theological society down there in the great town, and he wanted to read a new paper to them. He wanted to take the text about growing up to the measure of the stature of Christ. And he says, work out an idea which I feel sure you'll be interested in. I'm going to point out how people always forget that Jesus, here the ghost bowed, was a comparatively young man when he died. He would have outgrown some of his earlier views, you know, if he'd lived, as he might have done with a little more tact and patience. I'm going to ask my audience to consider what his mature views would have been. A profoundly interesting question. What a different Christianity we might have had if only the founder had reached his full stature. I shall end up by pointing out how this deepens the significance of the crucifixion. One feels for the first time what a disaster it was, what a tragic waste, so much promise cut short. Oh, must you be going? Well, so must I. Goodbye, dear boy. It's been a great pleasure, most stimulating and provocative. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. And the ghost nodded his head and beamed at the spirit with a bright clerical smile and turned away, humming softly to itself, City of God, how broad and fair. Just, well, that's the end of that conversation. Then we meet Ikey again as he tries to fill up his pockets with some real things, and then a voice says, Fool, put it down, you cannot take it back. There is not room for it in hell. Stay here and learn to eat such apples. The very leaves and the blades of grass in the wood will delight to teach you. So there isn't room in hell for even the smallest piece of reality. There's a chapter on cynicism, a chapter on shame, in which a woman would really rather die than be seen in this state as a shadow. And the bright spirit says, Friend, could you only for a moment fix your mind on something, not yourself? Oh, I've already given you my answer, the ghost said coldly, but still tearful. And then the ghost, the bright spirit, just set a horn to his lips and blew, and the whole earth shook, and the person was scared out of her shame. In the middle section of the book, about chapter 9, Lewis meets George MacDonald, who was the 19th century theologian that most influenced Lewis himself. And then they talk about heaven and hell. They have a very interesting encounter as they watch one woman. This is her dialogue. I want to read this on page 73. It's not really dialogue. The ghost's talk went like this. Oh, my dear, I've had such a dreadful time. I don't know how ever I got here at all. I was coming with Eleanor Stone, and we'd arranged the whole thing, and we were to meet at the corner of Sink Street. I made it perfectly plain because I knew what she was like, and if I told her once, I told her 100 times I would not meet her outside of that dreadful Marjorie Banks woman's house, not after the way she treated me. That was one of the most dreadful things that happened to me. I've been dying to tell you because I felt sure you'd tell me I acted rightly. No, wait a minute, dear. Wait till I've told you. I tried living with her when I first came, and it it was all fixed up. She was to do the cooking and I was to look after the house. And I did think I was going to be comfortable after all I'd been through, but she turned out to be so changed, absolutely selfish, not a particle of sympathy for anyone but herself. And as I once said to her, I do think I'm entitled to a little consideration, because you at least lived out your time, but I oughtn't to have been here for years and years yet. But of course I'm forgetting, you don't know, I was murdered, simply murdered, dear. That man should never have operated. I ought to be alive today, and they simply starved me in that dreadful nursing home, and no one ever came near me, and the shrill, monotonous whine died away as the speaker, still accompanied by the bright patients at her side, moved out of hearing. What troubles ye, son? Asked my teacher. I am troubled, sir, because that unhappy creature didn't seem to me to be the sort of soul that ought to be in danger of damnation. She isn't wicked. She's only a silly, garrulous old woman who has got into a habit of grumbling, and one feels that a little kindness and rest and change would put her all right. That's what she was once. That is maybe what she still is. If so, she certainly will be cured. But the whole question is whether she is now a grumbler. Oh, I should have thought there was no doubt about that. Ah, ye misunderstand me. The question is whether she's a grumbler or only a grumble. If there is a real woman still inside the grumbling, it can be brought to life again. If there's one wee spark under those ashes, we'll blow it till the whole pile is red and clear. But if there's nothing but ash, we'll not go on blowing them in our own eyes forever. They must be swept up. But how can there be a grumble without a grumbler? Oh, the whole difficulty of understanding hell is that the thing to be understood is so nearly nothing. But you'll have had experiences. It begins with a grumbling mood, and you yourself still distinct from it, perhaps criticizing it, and yourself in a dark hour may will that mood, may embrace it. You can repent and come out of it again, but there may come a day when you can do that no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood, not even to enjoy it, just the grumble itself going on forever like a machine. That's scary, but that's Lewis's vision of hell is. See, as long as we are able to react critically to the wrong choice, to the evil that we do, as long as that, you see, then one ought to have some comfort. I thought about that this morning when Mary read this passage from Philippians about the peace that passes understanding. For the whole point of the peace of God is that it plunges us into controversy and conflict within ourselves. That is, that it turns the good work that God is beginning in us against the old self, the evil that is a part of us. So to be plunged into the peace of God is to be plunged into struggle, into conflict. If there is that part of us that can still criticize what we are doing, then, says MacDonald, we are on the way to heaven. But if there is no longer any critical voice in us, then we have literally become the evil that we were once doing. Yeah, that's the scary picture. In this same chapter, there's a marvelous... we haven't got time to finish it now. He portrays a habit as something that can be, not a habit, a passion, as something that can either ride us, take over our lives, or be ridden, be driven by us. And the way he portrays that is just marvelous. He's got a picture here of a mother who loved her children excessively and therefore did not really love them at all. A marvelous portrait of a wife who set out to make something of her husband and destroyed him and her in the process. In the end, Lewis has just this little thing, which tells us this is the conclusion of the book. screaming, I burrowed my face in the fold of my teacher's robe. The morning, I cried. I'm caught by the morning, and I am still a ghost. But it was too late. The light, like solid blocks, intolerable of edge and weight, came thundering upon my head. Next moment, the folds of my teacher's garment were only the folds of the old ink-stained cloth on my study table, which I had pulled down with me as I fell from my chair, and the blocks of light were only the books which I had pulled off with it, falling about my head. I awoke in a cold room, hunched on the floor beside a black and empty grate, the clock striking 3, and the siren howling overhead. Well, so he dreamed it. But maybe it's the kind of dream that can illuminate the choices that we are making day by day. And the question is whether we are building prisons of illusion that will eventually leave us nothing, or whether we are really living already in that kind of reality which will one day become heaven. One of Lewis's point is that for the damned, earth will already have been hell, and for the saved, earth will already have been heaven. Well, we are in the place where the choices are now being made. I like this book. Hope you do too.